we were made not primarily that we may love God, though we were made for that too, but that God may love us, that we may become objects in which the divine love may rest well pleased.
This is Mission 66, a TWR outreach in partnership with the ministry of Dr. Luis Seau. Today, we're on our journey through the book of Job. Instead of the story of an entire nation or royalty, we'll zoom in to the life of an ordinary God-following man. We'll be joining John Matthews and Esther Sisulu for this conversation. Grab your study guide at mission66.org, follow along, and see how God's Word speaks to your life today. Now here's Esther.
Welcome as we continue our look in the book of Job today. Now, can a man serve the Lord for nothing? Well, that is the question which will be answered by Job, who was faithful during his painful trial, even though he didn't quite understand why he was going through all of this trouble. And as we journey through these five chapters in the book of Job, our teacher John Matthews will guide us with the theme, What Profit?
Thank you, Esther, and a very warm welcome to this latest episode of Mission 66. So good to be with you. And yeah, we're in the middle section now of this incredible story in Book of Job. And the story begins as the devil challenges God. What happens? Well, the devil goes to God and he claims that the only reason that Job is faithful to God is because of what he gets out of it. And it seems to the devil that he's getting an awful lot out of it. He's blessed in terms of health, wealth, and so many different things. And God permits the devil to harass Job with pretty much every kind of earthly difficulty imaginable. That includes losing his wealth, losing his 10 children. He's struck down with this dreadful disease, which means he's covered from head to toe in sores. And the devil's assertion is, once those things are taken away from Job, he will curse and disown God. And the root of his faith, i.e. the things around him, will become apparent. And then on top of that, you've got these three men who appear. The Bible refers to them as friends. They don't seem that great a bunch of friends, let's be honest. So much so that in the last episode, Job turns to them and says, you lot are a miserable bunch of comforters. Because what are they doing? Well, they're accusing him of sin. They're saying, look, Job, you wouldn't be suffering unless you had done something seriously, seriously wrong. Well, that's miserable comfort, isn't it? And so here we have these three guys. Their names are Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Job's friends, and they suggest that Job has brought all of this suffering upon himself. Three friends launch into their tirade against Job once, twice, and now they're full of words for a third time. And imagine three so-called pals speaking this harshly to someone suffering as badly as Job is suffering, which does nothing more than add to his torment. And they're not easy words to read. You kind of, we've had the three of them speaking already, and I'll be honest with you, as I read them, I'm like, oh, here we go, you three again. I've heard more than enough from you. That's me reading here in this day and age. Imagine how Job felt. Well, anyway, he had to hear it firsthand. And so let's try and put ourselves in his shoes. Job 22, verse 2. Off goes Eliphaz again, saying, can a man be profitable to God? Surely he who is wise is profitable to himself. Is it any pleasure to the Almighty if you are in the right, or is it gain to him if you make your ways blameless? Is it for your fear of him that he reproves you and enters into judgment with you? Is not your evil abundant? There is no end to your iniquities, for you have exacted pledges of your brothers for nothing and stripped the naked of their clothing. You have given no water to the weary to drink, and you've withheld bread from the hungry. The man with power possessed the land, and the favoured man lived in it. You have sent widows away empty, and the arms of the fatherless were crushed. Therefore, snares are all around you, and sudden terror overwhelms you, or darkness so that you cannot see, and a flood of water covers you. Now, this guy has absolutely no proof that Joe is guilty of any of this, but up he comes with, in his own limited logic, this long list of supposed sins. He's also saying that if Job were to merely admit that he'd done all these things, that everything would instantly return to what it was before. Verse 21. Agree with God and be at peace. Thereby good will come to you. Receive instruction from his mouth and lay up his words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you will be built up. If you remove injustice far from your tents, if you lay gold in the dust and gold of Ophir amongst the stones of the torrent bed, then the Almighty will be your gold and your precious silver. And interesting, isn't it, that again, something of what these three friends say is true, and something of what Eliphaz here says is true. God is more precious than silver and gold to those who are faithful to him and come under the security of his protection, of his wings. But to a sufferer, maybe these words would seem like foolishness, which we see in Job 23. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. I would lay my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know what he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No, he would pay attention to me. There an upright man could argue with him, and I would be acquitted forever by my judge. Behold, I go forward, but he is not there, and backward, but I do not perceive him. On the left hand, when he is working, I do not behold him. He turns to the right hand, but I do not see him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come out as gold. So there we see Job wondering where God is in this trial. But he has confidence that he will come through this time of testing better than he went in. Isn't that brilliant foresight? Because in saying that, Job is starting to understand the purpose of what God is doing here. And it is for Job's ultimate and incredible good, even though he couldn't foresee it at this stage. And then in chapter 24, Job protests that he's being tested and tried whilst the wicked seem to be getting away with murder. This is Job 24, which says, why are not times of judgment kept by the Almighty? And why do those who know him never see his days? Some move landmarks, they seize flocks and pasture them. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless. They take the widow's ox for a pledge. They thrust the poor off the road. The poor of the earth all hide themselves. Behold, like wild donkeys in the desert, the poor go out to their toll, seeking game. The wasteland yields food for their children. They gather their fodder in the field, and they glean the vineyard of the wicked man. They lie all night naked, without clothing, and have no covering in the cold. They are wet with the rain of the mountains, and cling to the rock for lack of shelter. They are those who snatch the fatherless child from the breast, and they take a pledge against the poor. They go about naked, without clothing. Hungry, they carry the sheaves. Among the olive rows of the wicked, they make oil. They tread the wine presses, but suffer thirst. From out of the city the dying groan, and the soul of the wounded cry for help. Yet God charges no one with wrong. There are those who rebel against the light, who are not acquainted with its ways and do not stay in its paths. The murderer rises before it is light, that he may kill the poor and the needy. And in the night he is like a thief. The eye of the adulterer also waits for twilight, saying, no eye will see me. And he veils his face. Almost as if Job lived in our day and age. How many powerful public figures steal, carouse, murder their opponents, and do evil openly, and yet nothing seems to happen to them. We see it in the news, don't we? Very often. And, well, there's nothing new under the sun. And evidently, the same was true back in Job's day. And then in chapter 25, Bildad the Shuhite adds yet more fuel to the fire with, well, I suppose you could only call it a doctrinal thesis on the sad case of man on earth. This is what he says. Dominion and fear are with God. He makes peace in his high heaven. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not arise? How then can man be in the right before God? How can he who is born of woman be pure? Behold, even the moon is not bright, and the stars are not pure in his eyes. How much less man who is a maggot, and the son of man who is a worm? So now Job, seeing he's not only suffering intensely, but also being compared to a maggot and a worm. And the only thing that we can say about Bildad's speech in chapter 25 is that it is mercifully short, which is not really like him. Job answers Bildad, though, with some scorn. In chapter 26, this is verse 2, Job saying, how you have helped him who has no power. How you have saved the arm that has no strength. How you have counseled him who has no wisdom, and plentifully declared sound knowledge. With whose help have you uttered words, and whose breath has come out from you? Job then goes on to describe the mystery of God's power and his might in creation, saying in verse 5, the dead tremble under the waters and their inhabitants. Sheol is naked before God. The Abaddon has no covering. He stretches out the north over the void and hangs the earth on nothing. He binds up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not split open under them. He covers the face of the full moon and spreads over it his cloud. He has inscribed a circle on the face of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astounded at his rebuke. By his power he stilled the sea. By his understanding he shattered Rahab. By his wind the heavens were made fair. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent. Behold, these are but the outskirts of his ways. And how small a whisper do we hear of him, but the thunder of his power. Who can understand? So poor Job, suffering as he is, and yet arriving at two great realizations. First, that there are mysteries in life that are way beyond understanding. And second is the fact that the righteous are not always, and very often are not, rewarded, and those who are truly guilty not immediately punished. And so what do we see here? We see a man, Job, who is growing more humble and actually more reflective, I think. And isn't it true that often when we come out of a season of suffering, we come out far different people than when we entered? And in this way, there is untold and incredible profit from even the most painful of seasons in our life, especially from those seasons. C.S. Lewis once put it this way: the problem of reconciling human suffering with the existence of a God who loves is only insoluble so long as we attach a trivial meaning to the word love and look on things as if man were the centre of them. Man is not the centre. God does not exist for the sake of man. Man does not exist for his own sake. Thou hast created all things, and for your pleasure they are and were created. We were made not primarily that we may love God, though we were made for that too, but primarily that God may love us, that we may become objects in which the divine love may rest well pleased.
I'm Esther, and we are looking into the book of Job at chapters 22 through to 26. And so, John, I do have a couple of questions here, and I hope that these questions actually align with what our listeners are asking. So let's start off by talking about Eliphaz. He's the guy who spoke first. Now, he seems to believe that all wealthy people are dishonest, they're evil, and they're always looking to take advantage of others. Now, I wonder if this could be the underlying reason for the accusations that he makes against Job, you know, because Job was wealthy.
Yeah, it could be. You know, the way that Eliphaz addresses Job in chapter 22 is, well, frankly, it's irrational, because he hasn't got any evidence, he hasn't witnessed anything, yet he still says, essentially, look, Job, since you are suffering so badly, you must be guilty of something really bad. And he then makes some suggestions of sins that Job might have been guilty of. Maybe you didn't give water to the thirsty. There you are as a landowner, you were living in comfort. Maybe you did not feed those who were hungry. And, you know, sometimes that short-sighted, bitter mindset we see in society sometimes today, how many of us have heard things such as, well, look, all business owners are corrupt. Look, every politician, they're all dishonest. Anyone with money, well, look, they're in it for themselves, and they probably got that way, got rich by compromising their ethics. And you know, sometimes we see that, and it's born ultimately out of a sense of jealousy.
John, you know, someone somewhere once said that all generalizations are wrong. And I think that's quite ironic, you know, considering that that's a generalization. But in this case, how can we actually consider this?
Yeah, I like that. It's quite funny, isn't it? It's a bit like the one that goes that 90% of statistics are wrong. Anyway, I digress. What are you saying? Yeah, no, look, I think what we see here is a judgmental attitude, no doubt about that, in the way that Eliphaz is really accusing Job. And yeah, I think you might be onto something there. It might well be an indication that Eliphaz was jealous or had been jealous of Job's prosperity, and perhaps deep down wasn't all that unhappy to see him lose it all. Look, I we don't know that for sure, but perhaps that's something to do with it. We certainly see that in relationships in our world today.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, we sure do. You know, here's another thought that occurred to me. Job here really seems to be struggling with this question that I think many people have asked, but just truly fail to understand. And that is, why God remains silent and seemingly passive in the face of all this evil that we face in the world. I think that's the issue that was raised in chapter 24.
And yet the truth is, isn't it, Esther, that God speaks in far more profound ways than our basic way of communicating as humans allows. And so I think I get why we look at it from an earthly viewpoint, but the truth is God is speaking all the time. The heavens declare the glory of God every single day. He speaks through the wonder of creation to anyone who observes it. And that sometimes is, and I speak for myself, I'm so busy in my mind, which is whirring and whizzing, that I don't stop and look to listen to God. He speaks clearly through his Spirit to anyone who's willing to listen. No doubt about that. When you have the Bible open and you clear your mind and you come to God and say, Lord, speak to me, he'll speak to you. There's no doubt about that. He is a God who speaks all the time. And I think one other thing that grabs our attention here as well, Esther, is the unjust suffering has always been a reality through time and eternity. You know, people get away with evil in the world. There is injustice. There's a lot of injustice. And it kind of seems that Job had never really noticed this before, but now that the situation has turned against him, he's starting to see a different side of the world. And clearly you would. He's seeing all that's wrong with the world because it's impacting him directly. And the Bible tells us that God is everywhere and he sees the bad, the evil, and he sees the good and the kind. He's a perfect God who can't bear to look on sin. And yet through the perfection of Jesus Christ, who took our sins upon himself, he sees us as pure somehow. It's a miracle. He's a patient God. And really, in his perfection, he could make an end of us every time that we sin, but he doesn't, because that's not what he wants. He loves us, and he wants to show his love for us. And so he extends this period of grace because of his incredible, immeasurable love for mankind. Esther, I think of all the times that I have sinned and all the times that I will sin. We need to accept who we are and what repeatedly has caused us to fall and will cause us to fall, and surrender that over and over and over again to God and ask his forgiveness. And you know what? He forgives us every time, and he runs to us like the father running to the prodigal son. And more than that, the more that we run to him, the more that we come to him, the more we fail but yet come back to him, the more time we spend with him, then all of a sudden that problem starts to diminish. Ultimately, God will bring everything to judgment, which is why the New Testament clearly tells us that there is a heaven and a hell, because sooner or later justice prevails. Now that's God's business, not ours. There are some wise thinkers throughout history who've said that the problem that should concern us is not the evil of the wicked, but the silence and the passivity of the righteous. Now Job had never worried about this before, but now, when he sat amongst the ashes and tragedy upon tragedy has befallen him and things are beyond tough for him, he sees it. And the question, I think, remains for us. How do we position ourselves in the face of evil in the world around us? I think instead of blaming God for allowing problems, I wonder whether, well, I don't wonder. I know that we are so, so far better off asking what we can do to intervene, to help, to let his love and his light and his hope and his peace flow through our every interaction And as God flows through us into the world around us, we're doing what we were created to do. And we're actually feeding straight into eternity.
Hmm. Oh yes, John, literally being the hands and feet of Jesus Christ. You know, I'd like for us to quickly have a look at chapter 26, because we see some very interesting words that appear here. Sheol and Abaddon. What do those terms mean in the context of Job?
Well, in this context, good question, Esther. Sheol is naked before God and Abaddon has no covering. Now, Sheol means the land of the dead. Now, the Hebrews made no distinction between the good and the bad, only the dead. Later came the understanding that the land of the dead has two compartments. Abaddon has to do with destruction. So there was paradise, which was sometimes known as Abraham's bosom, the place of the faithful dead. And then there was Abaddon, which was the other place where the unrighteous were kept until their final judgment.
Interesting. That's very interesting. And then Job mentions Rahab, saying God shattered Rahab. Now, of course, this wasn't Rahab who lived in Jericho that he was talking about, right?
No, it's not. Rahab, in this context, is referring to a sea monster, similar to the fleeing serpent that is mentioned in verse 13, which is also called Leviathan, a sea creature that some scholars think may have been mythical. Now, there are more conservative scholars who suggest it could refer to animals, other animals, for example, while there are some who believe it might depict creatures that we no longer have with us today. Look, either way, these terms are meant to symbolize chaos, evil, or divine terror within creation. And sometimes the name Rahab is used to symbolize ancient Egypt. You can find references to Rahab as Egypt in both Psalm 87 and Isaiah chapter 51.
You know, when these creatures are mentioned, and you even using the word mythical, you really can't help but wonder whether these could have been prehistoric animals.
And there were, as we know, prehistoric animals, because in the time before the flood of Noah, the world before history essentially was effectively being recorded as it is now. Well, it was still in a pretty pristine environment. Mankind at that time were living hundreds and hundreds of years, as were the animals. And it's also known that reptiles continue to grow as long as they're alive. So what we call dinosaurs were actually reptiles, large reptiles who lived hundreds of years ago, and they continue to grow, some to a huge size. And look, we still see their bones being dug up, and you can also see them displayed in museums across the world.
I suppose then the dinosaur mystery can really just be solved by believing the biblical account of Noah's flood.
Well, look, we can't be sure, but I believe the ancients had a better understanding of the way that things worked than we give them credit for. For instance, in chapter 26, verse 7, Job says here, "He stretches out the north over the void and hangs the earth on nothing." Now, that could have been merely poetic language, like when he covers the moon with thick clouds. But Job's description of the earth being hung on nothing, well, that went against the later beliefs of the Greeks, who believed that the earth was being carried on the shoulders of a giant god. So Job's statement has been borne out by modern science and astronomy and the understanding of what gravity means. But how could he have known so long ago? So we're talking about people who were from a much more developed society than we would perhaps give them credit for today.
Well, there certainly are quite a lot of mysteries that we, within our own capacity, can't explain. And, well, the Bible doesn't necessarily explain all these mysteries too.
No, that's right. And neither does it try to, Esther. And so, as such, we shouldn't expect Job or even the Bible to contain all of the scientific details we know today. You know, there's plenty in the Bible that points to later revelation, that's for sure. But there is a wisdom at the heart of this as well. We don't need to know everything. We don't have the capacity to absorb everything. And we don't always need to know why. In fact, Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 29 says that the secret things belong, they belong to the Lord our God. But the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children to do them. So God reveals to us just what we need and no more.
And for that, God is so good. Wow. John, that's all the questions that I have for today. Thank you so much for your insights. I think this has been helpful for our listeners. So let's go ahead and move into the summary of these five chapters.
Yeah, so today you're right. We were in Job chapters 22 through to 26, and the theme was what profit? And the devil here, he's afflicted Job, and he's trying to get him to wonder whether it's of any profit to carry on serving God. And you've got Job's friends who are, in effect, doing him no good at all and aiding the devil's aim, actually, inadvertently. And they're led by Eliphaz, who wrongly accused Job of hidden sin. They claim that his suffering must be punishment for stuff that he's done wrong in his life. And Eliphaz then starts to list these unproven charges and urges Job to repent of these unknown sins, whilst Bildad then adds a grim portrayal of humanity's worthlessness. And what their harsh words, Esther, are doing are just deepening the anguish of a man who's pretty down and out as it is. But yet, isn't it amazing that amidst all of that, Job is yet at the end of this, responding with confidence in God's justice and this longing to present his case before the court of heaven. And he, Job, acknowledges the mystery of divine ways, recognizes that the righteous suffer whilst the wicked prosper on earth. And he also marvels at God's power in creation, describing God's authority over life, over death, over the cosmos. And through suffering, we see that Job is growing more reflective and humble, grappling with the complexities of life. And so human understanding remains limited, and God's purposes, well, they often remain hidden for now. But his purposes will always be accomplished.
And it is on that firm truth that we conclude this episode of Mission 66. Thank you for joining us. Now, we'll continue same place next time as we move further into the book of Job. So until then, dear friends, may God bless you.
As Mission 66 comes to a close, be sure to download your free study guide at mission66.org. Deepen your daily devotion with insights from each episode, and let John and Esther lead you through the scriptures. Get your study guide at mission66.org and be prepared for our next episode. There, you can also connect with us, ask questions, or donate to help Mission 66's worldwide outreach. Head to mission66.org. Mission 66 is made possible through Transworld Radio in partnership with Dr. Luis Seau.